The Making Of is sponsored by Missoma.
Every piece of a woman's jewellery tells part of her story. Earrings she bought with her first paycheck, a pick-me-up present from her best friend after a crappy breakup, the matching bracelets they got on that wild holiday, her 18th birthday, her 30th birthday, an anniversary gift she'll never forget. From past loves to career milestones, from morning to night, we wear our treasured moments, whatever shape or size. And Missoma is here for all those moments. They're on a mission to build a more confident, creative and collaborative world, starting a chain reaction, one link at a time. Make your moments last forever with Missoma and get an exclusive 15% by using Make15 now on Missoma.com.
Welcome to The Making Of, a podcast from the female lead. I'm Bea Appleby, and in this series, I'll be talking to some of my favourite women about the moments that have made them. The highs, the lows, the life lessons, but I promise we won't call them journeys. My guest today is the award-winning poet, Holly McNish.
Choice is a funny thing in a world that tells you that you're not really relevant unless you are a mother as a woman. You know, I'm told that about having one kid, don't you want two kids? You know, the pressure to have a baby is nuts. So don't say, oh, well, you chose to have a baby. It's like, it's a choice in a closed culture in that way. Women that choose not to have babies are also demonised.
Holly was UK Slam Poetry Champion in 2009 and went on to win the prestigious Ted Hughes Award for Poetry in 2016. She's released 4 books of poetry and her 5th collection called Slug is out this month. Holly and I spoke about everything from childbirth to the magic of words, and she even performed one of my favourite poems. Oh, and here's a warning, we talked a lot about sexy stuff, including why knees can be very arousing. So, here we go. Holly McNish, welcome to our podcast. I'm a big fan, and so are so many of our audience, so this is such a thrill. We are going to talk about 6 moments that have shaped you. Let's start with moment number 1. This is your primary school teacher telling you that the sun is a star.
Yeah.
What happened?
It just blew my mind. Like, if I remember right, I just remember the feeling of just sitting stunned. Just being like, what do you mean? The sun is a star. Because obviously I'd been looking up at the stars. I loved looking at the stars. Thought there's so many of them. They're so far away. And I just never put the 2 and 2 together. I would have never have said that the sun was the same as a star ever in my childhood. And yeah, when she said that, I just felt like, one, excited, but also I felt a bit duped. Like, oh, like, I only think that it's not a star because it's got a different name. Whereas I know I've heard the phrase, like, Earth Star. So I guess if all my life it had been called Earth Star, I might not have been so bowled over. But I just remember for, like, well, still now, to be honest, still if I think, I look at the stars and I think they're all a sun. Like, every one of those stars is a sun to a solar system. It just bowls me over. Yeah. I think that was the first life-changing moment, just knowing that, like, labels and language totally,
so it's about words,
yeah, totally shaped the way we think.
Were words something that you were really into at school? Were you into writing poetry at that point? When
yeah, I was. I really was. I think, thinking back, like, I wrote poems when I was little, not loads and loads, but I used to write, like, my mum poems for Mother's Day, and I used to keep a diary and poems and draw pictures next to them all. The teenage ones are probably the best ones to read, I think. I think poetry is just freer for me. Like, the prose is so, doesn't have to be, but it's much more structured. And I guess it was more what I was doing at school. But poetry, it's so free, and there's so many different forms you can use. And I loved rhyme, and I loved, like, playing with rhyme. And it just seemed a sort of fun way, I guess, to write down my thoughts about not getting into nightclubs and stuff like that.
The power of poetry to make you feel something so quickly is incredible. Like, this morning, I read your poem, Sweet Separation, which I'd read before. And that poem goes, I mean, it would make a mum cry, and it would make someone that doesn't have a child cry because they remember. I mean, it's just so universal, you know, like, the experience of your child growing up is really, like, you know, that just gets you. But also, you know, being a child of a parent and knowing how they felt and how you feel about growing up, you know, it's just like, you've just got to the essence of, like, human existence then, basically.
I'll take it. I'll take the quote. Yeah. That'll be on the front of the book.
Could you read it? Would you mind? Or can you
No, I don't
it?
Mind at all. All right, so this
okay,
is...
Okay, I'm going to try and hold it together.
Sweet separation. How strange it is, this feeling, swaddling you in love, just to help you leave me. First, you did not need my body anymore. Tombstone of a star, stormed out blind and screaming. Then you did not need my heartbeat anymore. Cord cut and pegged till current stopped, till tide dried up, till shriveled skin. Our bitter, carnal closeness dashed into a dustbin. Then you did not need me, breasts hardening, redundant. Cabbage leaf companions to ease the swell of loss. Then you did not need me to hold your head as you sat up, to hold your hand as you walked, to hold the spoon as you ate, to jog beside your bicycle, to catch a falling roller skater, to run beside your scooter, to sit beside your bed, to read a story till you sleep, to run my finger under every letter, to mouth each word you read. Oh,
it's really good. Thanks. Well done, Holly.
Weirdly, I get most sad when I read about the roller skating, which is ridiculous because I love roller skating with my kid and I love not having to like have her shout at me because I like won't won't help her get up and yeah. stuff. But I sort of yeah, it's like oh.
It's the finger under every word that gets me. Oh. I don't know why. I think it's that phrase is beautiful because you literally do that, but it's also just like what you do as a parent. You're like literally yeah. going through every single thing that child does. Oh my God, I'm crying. Oh. Stop.
No, my daughter, like she doesn't really read obviously a lot of my poems. I sometimes force her to listen to them and then she sort of runs away. But that one, after she heard that at a gig, she sort of guiltily asked me to read to her. And I was like, listen, I'm sad about it, but I don't want your pity. Yeah, there's new things we can do together. She was like, no, please, do you want to read one of the stories I used to read? It's like, listen, you don't have to do this, but all right.
Oh, that's so sweet. That's really sweet. Well, actually, that brings us really well onto our next point, which is like child guilt. Oh. So this is your moment number two, which is the day I told my mum nastily to go away when she just got back from work. Now, what is this moment? How so old are you?
I must have been about 14, I reckon, because I was sat doing like art homework. I remember I was trying to draw the house opposite. But yeah, so my mum used to get home. She did night shift as a nurse when I was little. So she was like knackered. And then tried to sleep in the day when I was at school, but I wanted to come home for lunch. So I used to like wake her up at lunch. Like it really worked her ass off. And sometimes she got back at about 6, I reckon. So this one day, so she got back from like a day of nursing. And I think something pretty horrible, I remember, had happened to one of the patients. But I didn't know that at the time. And she immediately, I heard the door shut and she immediately walked up the stairs basically to see how I was, which I totally took for granted. I now realise that she did that like first thing before even like getting herself a tea, nothing, just came up to see how I was doing. And I remember it so vividly, sat in my window and I didn't even turn my head. I just went, oh, go away. I don't even know how I did it. Like I wasn't really like moody teenager. I didn't have a lot of problems as a teenager that was like getting off my chest. I just obviously couldn't be asked to talk to my mum or something. Don't know. Or I was annoyed about the homework was probably what it was. And she just walked out of the room. And then I heard a kind of sobbing coming from her and ran out of the room. Like immediately felt terrible and ran out of the room. I was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. She was like, no, it's fine. I've just had a really bad day. And her really bad days, like compared to being a flipping writer, her really bad work days are like bad. My really bad work days are like, oh, there's too much admin to reorganise at all. Like, it's not on the same level yeah. at all. I'm not an essential worker. She definitely was. And we talked about it and the stuff that had happened. But I still remember it. And she always tells me to get over it. I told her this morning even on the phone that I was doing this. And she was like, well, what were your moments? And I was like, oh, you remember that time I told you to go away? And she was like, oh, my God, Ollie. Like, get over the guilt. But then because I told her that, she told me hers. So she'd thought about her 6.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and one of hers was when she forgot about Father's Day. And she was like, her dad told her, like, for God's sake, get over it. But she can't, like, she still thinks about it, which I guess is quite similar. I remember it, I think, in a way to remind me that you do not know what somebody else is going through. And it's a really egotistical, arrogant thing, I think. I've never been, like, suffered from depression or anxiety or sort of overwhelming states like that. I don't know what it's like. So I'm talking in kind of not those terms. But just when people are, like, moody or annoyed, to let that mood go on to somebody else, I think is really unfair. And just not knowing that she'd had such a bad day. But it shouldn't really matter. If she'd had a good day, I've got no right to just be a dick to somebody or be a bitch, to be more gender neutral. Yeah, it just made me think, God, you're horrible. And I hadn't really thought that before, because I was always, I think, pretty nice to everyone and kind, and kind of prided myself on it a little bit. And I remember realising the power that you have to just make someone's day, like, even more shit. And that you don't know when you even pass someone on the street. I've been thinking that in lockdown a lot. I get really annoyed when people, like, don't smile at me. If they, like, look at me and I smile and they just carry on looking and don't smile. So I've got to get over that. But with me, like I said to my daughter, you know, that person said thank you, so just smile. Like, give them a smile. You've got no idea if this is, like, the only time they've got out, if this is, like, the brink of them just feeling terrible today. You just don't know what other people are going through.
I hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. I just want to take a minute to tell you a bit more about The Female Lead. We're a charity founded by Edwina Dunn, exploring the factors that limit women's success and fulfilment. By listening to women and understanding them through research and data, we aim to influence businesses and government to drive real change. We're passionate about telling women's stories, and that's what this podcast is all about. So please do rate and subscribe at the end. It will really help us to continue our work and tell more women's stories. Let's move on to moment number three.
Oh, yeah.
Which, and now, Holly, this is rather racy. I don't think we've ever had anything as racy on this podcast before.
No way, I don't believe that.
We had Catelyn Moran talking about a bit of this. So, moment number three, I'm blushing, is your first orgasm.
Yeah.
What happened?
Just had an orgasm, that's it. I mean, it wasn't... Yeah, it's not like an amazing... I just think we get so fixated on your first time always being penetrative sex, basically, the first time you had that. But I had loads of first times sexually that were more... I mean, my first time having penetrative sex was pretty lovely and beautiful, but there were other first times that were, like, you know, surpassed it. And I think we're so fixated, weirdly, on this, like, losing your virginity stuff, which I really hate as a phrase. But definitely the first time I was like, oh my God, I am a genius. This is amazing. I was just on my own in bed and just managed to have an orgasm finally. And I think I'd been, like, trying and practicing and not. It's not so obvious. Like, some people find it really obvious what to do with a vulva, but I didn't really. There's no, like, wanking sign for that, is there, which there is with, like, a penis. I remember at school just doing that sign loads. So we sort of have a rough idea, but still made many mistakes, I have to say, in that respect. But I think it's maybe more obvious with a penis what to do, because it's just more culturally talked about. And there seems to be loads of different ways that different people with vulvas and vaginas do it. So that's also confusing. Mm. But yeah, I just remember that feeling when you finally sort of go over the edge and realising, like, this is what my mate was talking about. And I remember I used to sort of kid myself that I'd already had one a few times. Like, oh, it's probably this. Yeah, this feels good. Yeah, this is... Yeah, I've probably have had an orgasm. I just don't know it. And then when I finally did, I was like, oh, this is, like, it's great. But just thinking, oh... Especially because there's so much around it, like, there's so much, like, sin around it, or there's so much, like, worry around it, and there's around sex in general. And I remember thinking, if this is what people are talking about, sexual pleasure, this is amazing, that I can do this on my own, in my bed, it's free. I can do it pretty much any time I want. Like, now I live on my own, I can do it any time at home. It's not quite the same when you're with, like, family. But I was just shocked that this thing, you know, when something's sort of built up, either in a sort of sinful way, I guess, by my sex education, it's like, this is what everyone's complaining about. Like, this is what we're not meant to do. That is ridiculous. Like, nothing's happened from this. Other than it feels
like completely. I was just thinking this when I was reading your moments, and I was like, why? There's still a lot of, it's still uncomfortable to talk about this.
Yeah.
Like, and, or not uncomfortable, but it's like, do it.
Totally.
And it's so bizarre in that, like, of all the sexual things you can do, it's like the least harmful and problematic. It's like, total consent.
Yeah.
It's to yourself. Like, it doesn't harm anyone, but there's still shame around it. It's so weird.
It's weird. It is weird. And there's even shame, maybe even more shame, because I don't live with my partner, and there seems to be more shame in me saying that I masturbate if I, like, I've told my daughter what it is, and, like, in a sort of, I talk about it, and then she's like, too much information, and sort of runs halfway through the conversation. So we've had, like, stuff, but I've had friends that have been pretty open that they, like, have sex with their husband to their kids, but they also coat it in, like, it's to make a baby, or it's, right, you know, whatever. Yeah. They have to give a reason, because we either we love each other or to make a baby. Those are the two only things, not because we enjoy it. It's not allowed still.
Yeah.
But the masturbating thing, that's like, you can't tell her that. It's like, but that's the same. That would be like if I had, like, I don't know. Yeah. And I guess, but the fact that it's not her dad that I'm having sex with makes it even more like, oof, you can't possibly tell your kid that you have sex with someone other than their father. Like, that's the next stage. It's like, oof. But we're very strange about masturbation, especially girls being brought up. The thing I really liked about it was that it started me thinking about my own turn-ons, which I hadn't really done before, because all my other sexual experiences had been with a guy, in which case I was sort of always slightly acting, because I think it's really hard for anyone to get out of your head what you're taught as sexy, because it starts from, like, I don't know, like the Cadbury's caramel bunny. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
Sex idea of what sexy starts from young, like Tinkerbell, from
so
all this
true.
Stuff. And I still am trying to just get everything out, and actually being on my own. And if I was masturbating and then letting me just think about stuff that I wanted to think about, like at first I would think, oh yeah, if I wear this like underwear, and I would think about it, but it wouldn't actually do anything to my like groin area. And having that thing in my head that was like, oh, actually, weirdly, thinking about this is what's turning me on, not thinking about that scene in the movie that I have been told is like the sexiest movie in the world, which does nothing for me, and realising that it's actually about my body and my pleasure, and then when you're with someone else, about them and that kind of two-way or three-way or whatever, how many other people are involved.
So, talking about bodies.
Yeah.
That moves us nicely onto moment number four, which was leaving the hospital after giving birth.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Now, let's talk about that. How old were you when you gave birth?
I was 27. I guess this is like a more sad one, I think. So I did have a lot of support, and the, you know, the midwives and doctors and stuff were amazing in the birth. My ex, my daughter's dad was great. My mum and his mum were also so supportive, but it was more, like, I had no idea what to do with a baby. Absolutely none. I'd held one baby once in my entire life. I was the youngest of all my cousins. So I gave birth at, like, 7, 8 in the morning, I think. And then I think it was about 4 that day when I was told I could leave the hospital. I didn't know that you bled afterwards. I didn't know anything about how milk would, like, be engorged, or how it would leak, or, you know, when the baby was feeding on one boob, that the other one would leak. Stuff like that. Maybe I hadn't read enough, but there was loads of this sort of gory, because they are gory details about birth and motherhood that I hadn't been told, I guess, to protect us, because you don't want to talk about that because people don't want to know. But not knowing was so rubbish. And I also, I guess because the baby takes up so much space in your body, I remember feeling from my ribs when they told me I could go, and feeling my ribs like higher than normal, or I thought they were higher, or maybe there was just this space in my body. But it's so weird, the psychological stuff of like, your body changing so quickly over 9 months and then changing again, it just wasn't talked about at all. And I don't think it still is, really. And I think that like mental and psychological stuff of like growing a baby, and then for your body and just the effect of your body, is a lot, especially in a culture that so like glorifies a certain type of body, or just, you know, not a body that's given birth, basically. And I was, yeah, I was bleeding and I was crying because I thought I couldn't really breathe very well because I felt like there was no space where my lungs had been. And I asked one of the nurses if I could see somebody about it, and she said, oh yeah, but it might take an hour, it might take six, because they were really busy. So I left, but it was just walking out the hospital, and I was, my daughter's dad was holding her, but I was just crying. Like, I left after giving birth, like, it's a massive deal, and I just left in tears, bleeding into a pad that they'd given me, because I didn't really know you bled. And I just remember feeling so, like, vulnerable and worthless. And this is not, it's not because of the people around me, like, family and friends were lovely, but it was like, I think as a pregnant person, I felt a bit crap when I was pregnant, but they're still like, oh, blooming pregnant person, oh, these pictures of women, you know, fair enough, do what you want. I have pictures of themselves pregnant under like waterfalls and stuff like that. There's a picture of Beyonce pregnant, not really a picture of Beyonce's body after she gave birth, you know, oh, look at this amazing person that's given birth. It's like this amazing person that's about to give birth is fine. We're sort of past the age of not allowing pregnant women like to present the news, which was in my grand's day, she said. But I just felt like shit, basically. And I thought, I've been awake for like 40 hours. I've done this absolutely unreal and very painful thing. My body has torn a bit. I've had stitches. And I also remember thinking, if I'd just been in hospital doing what I was doing, but not to give birth to a baby, I feel like I would have been told to go and lay in bed for 2 weeks. The aftercare, I think, would be amazing. Or at least you'd be like, do not lift anything. Do not lift anything. I remember my mum saying, don't lift stuff. You've just like basically pushed something out of your vagina. It's very wider than it would be. It needs you to not be lifting stuff so that it can heal. But no one said that. And one of my friends in France said she got handed a glass of champagne when she gave birth in hospital, and that's quite a standard thing. I don't know if that's true, but in her hospital the mothers were given a small glass of champagne, and I think even that would have, like, I might not have wanted it, but even just to be like, well done.
I just want to tell you that I also left hospital crying as well when I left with my baby. And I remember the nurses, as they were saying goodbye to me, and they were like, is everything okay at home? Like, it was so weird because they must have seen this so many times before, but I was like, just so overwhelmed. Like, when you were explaining your moments and what you wrote to me, you were saying, like, how it changed everything about how you looked at the world and how you thought about yourself, even how you felt about, like, your boss saying you'd made a bad cup of coffee. Yeah. Like, because you basically, after you've done that and you realise the awesomeness of what you've done, you're just a bit like, leave me alone.
Yeah. And I always feel awkward talking about this because I know there's people that have had horrendous experiences, and a couple of my friends who've had stillbirths and people who've had miscarriages, people that can't have kids that desperately want them. But also none of those friends would want me to then say I've learned nothing from this massive experience, because they've obviously also learned a lot from their experiences, which are just as valid. And I had a lot more anger as well for things like the way we demonise teen mums. That, like, came out a lot, I guess, because I was quite young when I was pregnant and I got called a teen mum a few times or shouted at, and also sort of treated it differently, I think, because people thought I was too young or got told I was too young to have a kid, all this sort of stuff. And I remember working with a group of teen mums and thinking, you've been through this. Like, you've been through this experience, but you just get seen as, like, nothing, pushing this pram around the streets, and you've had this experience, but no one's sort of telling you to be at all empowered by it or to feel at all like proud that you've done something like this. It's just like, oh, you had sex too young, oh, you had a baby too young. And yeah, it changed my outlook a lot and stuff like that.
And then I've read you talking about the anger you felt after you had a baby, about the things that you hadn't been told, and you hadn't really been told how hard it was. Can you tell a bit about that?
It just makes me so angry, because not talking about how hard it is means you get no credit for any of it. And it's already like the biggest unpaid labour, like caring, I mean, in general on the planet. So if we don't talk about how hard it is, we don't get the credit for it. And I think it was also speaking to my gran, and she said that when she gave birth, they weren't even allowed to talk about anything to do with the body. So I wasn't prepared for it, but I was, you know, able to say to my daughter's dad, oh my God, I'm still bleeding, or if people come around, but I need to wee in the bath or whatever. Like, none of that she could talk to about anyone, because she just didn't mention it. So she not only, you know, didn't get that kind of care, but she also just had to pretend like it was nothing. My granddad was very nice, she said, but he didn't know that she shouldn't really be walking around lifting stuff, because he had no idea how the baby was even born or what happened, or that she was bleeding, or that, you know. So it was like, oh, life just carries on as normal because everyone does it, it's a normal thing. So I think, I know people are a bit funny about talking about any, like, any female fluid or blood or anything, isn't it? But it's really hard, like, it's and I want the credit. Like, it's really hard looking after a baby. It's really difficult, and it seems the main thing that I seem to see people say, it's like, well, you chose to have a baby. It's like, cool, yes, I did, but you also chose to take my sponsorship money to run a marathon for, like, this, and you're expecting fucking credit for running a marathon. Like, you chose to do that, and now you're complaining that your feet are bleeding in your trainers. It's the same, yeah? I've given you a lot of sympathy and a tenner. You've not paid me anything for my marathon. But, yeah. But I hate that. And also, some people don't choose to have a baby. And also, choice is a funny thing in a world that tells you that you're not really relevant unless you are a mother as a woman. You know, I'm told that about having one kid. Don't you want two kids? You know, the pressure to have a baby is nuts. So don't say, oh, well, you chose to have a baby. It's like, it's a choice in a closed culture in that way. Women that choose not to have babies are also demonised. Like, come on.
I absolutely hate that argument. Like, especially during lockdown when everyone was homeschooling and women especially were complaining about how incredibly hard it was, and then a lot of people be like, well, you chose to have children, and you're like, so by that rationale, am I not allowed to complain about anything that I had a choice in? I know. Like, that's nuts. That's completely insane. But also,
you could extend it to anything, couldn't you? Like, yeah. Anything that you go to the doctors for, well, you chose not to eat 5 fruit and vegetables every day. Like, you chose to have that coffee in the morning. There's so much, like, that we do.
All of those key workers, all of those people working in the NHS, they chose to be doctors and nurses.
Isn't it?
So
exactly.
They can't complain.
Yeah.
So I'm going to move on to moment 5. It's another racy one, which is... Oh, God. This is sitting opposite your boyfriend on a train in Paris.
Yeah.
This is about the sexiness of knees.
Yeah, his knees. just his. I'm not sure about the people. I think there's just so much shit that I read and see every day telling me what sexy is. And this was just another one of those moments which I need to keep having to remind myself that it is not weird not to be turned on by one guy shoving his penis in 3 times on top of you. If you are, cool. You know, but that is like the normal heterosexual sex I see everywhere is just, I don't think does it for most women that I know. So this was on a train from Paris to a place called Grez-sur-Lyon, and it was a very romantic setting, and I fancy him a lot. But this moment, we were just sitting on one of those chairs, not a table between, so it was like facing each other. And I don't know if he did it on purpose or not. I don't think he can remember. But his knees just touched my knees, and it basically sent that thing when you're very quickly turned on, just straight into my groin. And I remember thinking, oh my God, I feel like really, really sexy or sexual or whatever the word should be right now. And I was staring at him, he was just looking out the window. Probably it was just an accidental knee touch, but I specifically stayed, you know, when you just want that small touch to carry on. So I don't know if we were even talking, maybe listening to music or something. And I was just looking out the window, just getting more and more horny, basically. But his knees, every time I like touch his knees, and sometimes in sexual situations, I'll be near his knees, I guess I could say. But it just reminds me of this most romantic moment. I talk with my friends a lot about it. Because I think everyone is so bombarded with images of what should turn you on, that if you believed it all, I'd be thinking that I should come from eating yogurt. Honestly, like, it's so, you know, it's like women's sexuality, especially, it's so overdone with stuff that is just not sexual unless you have a yogurt fetish or whatever. And it's so under talked about, the stuff that actually makes most women likely to feel pleasure.
You said that it made you realise that all the media and all the sex education about what is sexy and what it should feel like to be sexy is just completely untrue. Do you think that's because it's defined by men?
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure that's what it is a lot. It's defined mainly by heterosexual cis men. People blame porn a lot, and I do think that porn has a lot to answer for a lot of horrendous stuff. But actually, I think like the sort of PG-12 rom-com is just as bad for having taught me what I should find pleasurable in the bedroom. In fact, worse than like a lot of the porn I see, which involves somebody going down on somebody for like 20 minutes. Like, you don't get that in a mainstream film. So to be fair, I think there's horrendous sides of porn, but also in terms of showing pleasure, like Hollywood, and I think is
porn
worse.
Doesn't...
Like, it's pretty much been proven that most people with vulvas do not orgasm from just, I mean, like, unprepared, unturned on penetrative sex, which is what you get in a lot of of TV. And a lot of my friends that have been dating and have said, you know, this isn't what is gonna make me come, aren't believed by guys in an annoying way. But also they've had the same education, so no wonder. I don't think it's so much of an arsehole thing, although many friends that beg to disagree. I think most people want to turn on their partners, but we've all been told the same shit, basically.
And just having these kinds of conversations is sort of, I think we're changing the world, Holly, by having this conversation, because it needs to come out, right? It needs to be out there.
But I do think that's an amazing thing about social media, for all its, I guess, like porn, for all its horrendous downsides. It is sort of the first time that a lot of art and conversations are being heard that don't have to go through official channels. And I don't think it's rocket science why we're then having loads more diverse conversations, because it doesn't have to be okayed. Like, I've done stuff for Channel 4 that was, you know, didn't get past the main commissioner. And like, one thing about touch, sort of about what we're talking about, that I did a poem with another poet, Kay Tempest, and we did it together. And it was all about touch and how we only see one type of touch on screen. And then it got... like near the end of being commissioned, and then the guy at the top said, oh no, we think the video suggested maybe we could do it naked, so we'd be naked and the poem would be sort of like put onto our flesh and stuff, and things like that. And loads of situations I've been in like that, where I've been filmed, especially, and there's been a film crew. Like, I talk about one in the book, where I did an advert for Jurex, and it was about the orgasm gap in heterosexual relationships. And they were quite serious poems they asked me to talk about painful sex is very different. A lot of women have more painful sex and think they should put up with it, think sex should be painful, think losing your virginity should be painful, like all this stuff. But then when I got to the set, it was in a bedroom with a single bed with like teddies all over the bed. And when I asked if I could move the teddies, because this is obviously, I'm reading poems, first of all, on a bed, but, you know, maybe it's because it's to do with sex and stuff. And then this guy who was my age just kept arguing that this is to give it a feminine touch. I was like, but doesn't it give it a childish touch? And eventually, because it's horrible being on your own in a set, I thought, you know, how many, if I was younger, if I was shyer, I would just be sitting next to a massive, fluffy teddy bear surrounded by ducks reading this poem. And how many... you know, I don't know, poets or pop stars, has that happened to? How many people, young guys and girls, that have gone into a situation like that? And eventually, even I gave up, because I managed to move this giant teddy. I managed to move a few ducklings off the bed. It was a single bed, which no adult I know has either. It was just so much prejudice going on in that setup for me to talk about sex. And then eventually, it's still on YouTube, I'm reading a poem about orgasm inequality, and there's still this like fluffy duck on the radiator because they refuse to like remove all of the deadies. But things like that, there's so much pressure to fit in. And I think actresses must have done it, you know, for years, being in films, being like, I would not be screaming this loud in this sex scene, but just doing it because everyone's watching you and you want to get on with your career. And yeah.
Let's move on to moment six, which is, moment number six is speaking to your grandparents when they were dying. And how long ago was that?
So with my gran, it was last year. So she died in lockdown last year. So it was speaking to her before lockdown. And also she was really ill, so I took like my daughter off school to go and see her, and then we went to see her in hospital, and then she was amazingly totally compos mentis fine, you know, got up to go to the toilet and stuff before she died. Like, it was amazing that we had that long with her. And then my other grandma, it was I guess about 5 years ago, I think. And then my granddad, I didn't speak so much to my dad's dad at all, but I was still there when he was quite ill and surrounded by family at home, in the same bed he was his mum birthed him in, actually, he died in, which was fairly amazing. And then my granddad, it was the day before he died, and I went and got a plane to Scotland in a panic, and then went to see him, and then he died that night. It's just sort of, I don't, not humbling in that way at all, not like in a sort of patronising way, but I just learnt so much from talking to my grandparents and just people that are a lot older than me in general. Like, I live next to a elderly woman who comes in every day and comes into my garden, has got dementia. I've had to explain about COVID about 500 times in the last year. But just learning from their experiences and that kind of intergenerational discussion, I guess. And then I guess with my grandparents, especially on my mum's side, they were very open about things that maybe other people's grandparents weren't. And sort of in a selfish way, I guess, I mean that they just reminded me how young I was.
Yeah, you said your grand... Yeah, she told you that she was dreaming about dancing.
Yeah, so she used to dance, and then she was too... Not too old to dance. We had like a Strictly competition every New Year until she was like 93. But she couldn't like dance the way she danced, you know, and go to dances. And she said, oh God, it's great that you still dream when you're my age because you can do all these things. And it just made me think, oh, I can do them, but I don't. Sometimes because I don't want to, obviously. But I think with dancing, especially, a lot of people don't do it because of embarrassment or just like stuff to do with sex, isn't it? We're so embarrassed to do stuff. Because people might laugh at us, or we can't dance that well, all of that stuff. And I just thought, this is so ridiculous, Holly. You're so young, you can still do this stuff. So please don't stop yourself from doing things because you're embarrassed to do them. Because I could see, and they talked about regrets and stuff, and I think it's really important to think about that. Especially because at every age, every birthday I've had, my friends have complained about being old since we were like 19, and it does my fucking nothing. It's so annoying. Like, you know, we turn 20, oh my God, we're so old. Like, we're not doing, oh my God, we're so old. And as I've got older, my life has got like vastly better. I had quite a good teenage years, but my life, you know, my sex, my knowledge about my body, my comfort in my own skin, just it's just so good. And my granddad said his 80s were the best years of his life. My gran said her 70s were the best. My mum said so far it was like her 50s. Like, no one I know has said their teenage years were best, but we idolise this youth for some weird reason. And I know, going back to it, but the sex stuff I find, we idolise like that kind of 19, 20, probably younger, sex life. It's mainly crap at that age.
It's like, really crap.
Really. It's like, it's just like any other skill. You just get better the more you practice and communicate and talk, or practice on your own or whatever. So I think we idolise youth, but no one in my family has said that their young days were the best. And they've, you know, my granddad's saying that his 80s were great. He was in the war, to be fair, so his youth was horrendous. And lots of people say, you know, once their kids leave home, they miss them terribly, but they can actually have more of their own life again and sort of feel guilty admitting it. So yeah, just that reminder. And it's gonna, you know, get well. We turn 30, it's like, oh my God, it's 30, oh my God. It's like, if you're still healthy and you're still doing, like, stop fucking complaining about getting older. It's never gonna change. It's just gonna keep happening. It's like, oh, really, I can't stand it. I can't stand
it.
That's
so true.
I just like the celebration of aging, but also, I guess, the sadness that my gran wanted to do loads more and didn't have the opportunity. And I do have the opportunity to do a lot of stuff that she didn't get to do.
Yeah, it really does make you think, like, make the most of it.
Yeah, and at one point you're going to get to the stage when you can only dream about doing stuff you do now. Like, you'll only be able to, whatever it is you love, run or skip or jump or trampoline or whatever, you'll only be able to do it if you dream about it or think about it. And so,
yeah.
Like, do it. Yeah. Do it now.
Oh, that's a good point to end on. I like it. That's good. Do it now. So my final question is, thinking about moments, if you have to like think back on a moment of just like pure joy and happiness, what would you choose?
I think currently, having very recently lost my gran, it would probably be playing Scrabble on holiday on the Isle of Arran with my daughter, my mum and my gran. We used to go on holiday together, the four of us. And that is definitely some of the best conversations and memories I have. So my daughter annoying my gran by only putting a three-letter word down as the first word and not opening up the board enough. I think that was a moment.
That's a really good one. And also brings us back to your first point, which was words.
Yeah, that's very good.
And that's the end. I hope you had a good time. Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this, please do rate and subscribe. We'll be back next week with another brilliant woman's story. If you want to know more about The Female Lead, please check out our website at thefemalelead.com or our Instagram or our Twitter or Facebook or TikTok or LinkedIn. You name it, we're there for you. See you next time.